This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. We are continuing our new series, There's No Planet B, where we want to share everything you need to know about the climate crisis. So in our first episode back in January, we explored why we're in a climate crisis. But now in our second episode of this ongoing series, we want to explore what the effects of the climate crisis will be on both people and the planet. And joining me now to lay it all out is Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist. He's also an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. And Dr. Matthew is no stranger to Earth Matters. He's also been on the show before to talk about Bite-Sized Climate Action, which is a series of fun, flexible and immersive short online modules designed by experts such as Dr. Matt himself in the conservation field to inspire Malaysian youth to act for climate. But today he's going to break it all down for us. Welcome, Matt. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm happy to be here. I'm doing well.
Thank you so much for joining me today. We did catch up, a few months ago, I think it was actually, with Dr. Helena Varkey as well, to talk about Bite-Sized Climate Action. That sort of inspired this series as well, getting down to the basics, getting people to know more. So thank you so much for joining me today. So now we want to talk about the effects of the climate crisis, right? So, okay, so we know that the Earth's average temperature has increased about 1 degree Celsius during the 20th century. Am I correct? I guess, what is the big deal? Why is this an unusual event in our planet's recent history?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Maybe we can think about what we mean by our planet's recent history. Of course, our planet is rather old, billions of years old. But I think a nice place to start from is about 12,000 years ago. So this is when the planet was just coming out of the most recent glacial period. So just before that, we had much bigger ice sheets in the polar regions. And then about 12,000 years ago, we entered the Holocene period. That's the name we give to this last 12,000 years. And in that period, lots of remarkable things have happened. So humans have transitioned from being hunter-gatherers to doing agriculture and to living in settlements and then more and more in bigger cities. And what's, I think, interesting from a climate perspective is this has been a very stable period this last 12,000 years. And so this is, I think, been conducive to society developing the way it has. And so then the last 100 years or so has indeed been very unusual in the context of this longer 12,000-year period. We do see a very, very large and rapid warming, which is outside of anything we've seen in this stable Holocene period until now. And so the scientists are very certain this rapid warming in the last 100 years is because humans are doing things, especially burning fossil fuels, which leads to the greenhouse gases entering the atmosphere and extra heat being trapped near the surface. So I think if we take that kind of perspective, we see that this is something very new for humans to face. And it's something that, we're not sure what it's going to do to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not quite sure what it's going to do to us, but maybe you can help sort of lay out how these sorts of small changes in temperature and people, it just is 1 degree, right? People think that's really tiny. How does that actually correspond to changes in the environment?
Okay, you're right. That 1 degree Celsius increase in the last 100 years or so, that number is for our global average surface temperature. And that alone, it may not tell us lots about what's happening in individual places. But at the same time, this global average number is very important, and it's the one that is referred to in the Paris Agreement, where we have goals to not have more than 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius of warming. Again, I think it's useful to look backwards in time. We get some interesting insights if we do that. So I said that about 12,000 years ago, we emerged from the most recent glacial period. If we go a little bit further back, about 20,000 years ago, this was the last, what's called the last glacial maximum. It was the most recent period where we've had the maximum extent of glaciation in the polar regions. And so at that time, we had much bigger polar ice sheets, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, covering much of Europe, North America, and Asia.
Okay.
And at that time, global average temperature was about 4 or 5 degrees cooler than it has been during the Holocene. And as well as having lots of water stored in ice in polar regions, we had less water, therefore, in the oceans. And so global sea levels were more than 100 meters lower than they are today, 100 meters. Again, a global average 4 or 5 degrees Celsius difference, very, very big differences. If we look at the environment in somewhere like Malaysia, there wouldn't be ocean between the peninsula and Borneo. You can travel by land between those two places because the sea levels were much lower. And so that has really massive implications for where rivers are, where forests are, where different creatures are. And indeed, at that time, it was also very important for how different human populations dispersed around different parts of the globe. So what sounds like a relatively small change in global average temperature can have really big impacts in our environment. And that 4 or 5 degrees Celsius number, that probably would be the absolute worst case amount of warming we could imagine by the end of this century. If things went really badly in terms of our ongoing greenhouse gas emissions and probably increases, I think that's quite unlikely, that extreme, but it's not out of the bounds of plausibility.
Okay. All right. And when people think about human-induced climate change, many of them think of it as something that will happen in the future, isn't it? We don't realize, or we don't want to think that it's happening now, but it is in fact an ongoing process. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, indeed, it's happening. You've mentioned already that the global average surface temperature has increased by about 1 degrees Celsius. But yeah, human-induced climate change is we can see it in other ways as well. So scientists have recorded for decades changes in rainfall patterns and rainfall characteristics. Now we have rising sea levels. We have reductions in ice, and that's ice that floats on top of the ocean. It's ice in glaciers in mountain regions. It's ice in these massive ice sheets that we still have in Greenland and Antarctica. So all of these different parts of the climate system we can see changing in recent decades. It's already happening. And again, we know these changes are being driven largely because we're burning fossil fuels and putting greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which creates warming. And so we know these trends will continue into the future unless we can stop the activities that are the ultimate cause.
Okay, so basically, you know, what you explained just now, those are the impacts, those are the effects that we are seeing today, right? So those are sort of the direct, I suppose, consequences. What about some indirect consequences, you know, that will come to impact us because of this climate crisis and because of these changes in temperature?
Yes. So I think what I've just described, I would say these are changes in our physical environment.
Okay.
And those changes can lead into impacts on things that we care about. So we can have some impacts on things like human health. If we have hotter temperatures and heat waves, that can be bad for our health. Changes in temperatures can also lead to changes in things like infectious diseases. Maybe going a bit more indirect, some of the systems upon which we completely rely, so example, our agricultural systems, our water resources, these can also be impacted by climate change. So we can end up with reductions in agricultural yields. We can have more variation in availability of water. And probably beyond that, we rely too on the natural ecosystems. So forests provide many what are sometimes called ecosystem services, and forests can also be affected by climate change. I agree. We can have some things that affect us immediately in a direct way, but there are also some types of impacts that are maybe not characterized by a single event, but they creep up on us gradually and continually and erode at our way of life, have kind of ongoing negative effects on health and well-being.
All right. And maybe you can help sort of localize this as well. You know, maybe for Malaysia in particular, what sort of impacts are we seeing today here in Malaysia, if at all?
Yes, that's a good question. And one of the things with climate impact is they can, you know, kind of appear in different ways in different places, depending on that local context. I mean, overall, we should anticipate that Malaysia will be affected in these ways. In many ways, I think Malaysia it can be classified as vulnerable to climate change impacts. We have long coastlines. We're already quite a hot country. So we would be vulnerable to increasing temperatures. We have lots of kind of biodiversity as well, which can be vulnerable. The Malaysian government, I think, recognizes some of these impacts. When the Malaysian government communicates to the United Nations in written reports, which it is required to do in relation to climate change, it's often emphasized the way that Malaysia is kind of vulnerable to these impacts. I think at this stage, the evidence about impacts happening already is kind of sometimes hard to disentangle from lots of other things. These are complex systems. But the amount of warming we have now and the amount of warming that we would approach in you know, within the coming decades, I think it will be likely that Malaysia is affected by temperature extremes and heat waves that affect people's health and can affect crop systems. As sea level continues to rise, then our coasts will be threatened and coastal cities and agricultural areas will be at risk of flooding. Malaysia also has you know, many surrounding oceans, and they are valuable as, I guess, fisheries. They're valuable for tourism reasons. One of the ecosystems that is most strongly affected by climate change that's happened already is coral reef ecosystems. And they are, I think, very, they're suffering damage already in Malaysia. And with a bit more warming, they could be really at risk of not existing anymore. So across all the different sectors, from human health to agriculture to water resources, there are, I think, significant impacts that Malaysia will increasingly feel.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist. He's also an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He's also part of the team behind Bite Size Climate Action. And today he's helping us unpack what are some of the effects of the climate crisis. This, of course, is our series, There's No Planet B on Earth Matters, where we want to share everything you need to know about the climate crisis. We'll be back for more after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Today, it's our There's No Planet B series, where we are exploring the effects of the climate crisis. There's No Planet B is our new series and an ongoing series where we want to share everything you need to know about the climate crisis. So today, as I mentioned, we're talking about the effects of the climate crisis, and helping me to unpack that is Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist. He's an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He's also part of the team behind Bite Size Climate Action, which is a series of fun, flexible and immersive short online modules designed by experts in the conservation field to inspire Malaysians to act for the climate, the youth in particular. Am I right, Dr. Ashfold? So today you're helping us to unpack the effects of the climate crisis, you know, both in the global sense, and just before the break, you helped sort of expand in the local sense, you know, how it's going to impact us. And as you said, you know, it's going to be across, you know, many, many different sectors. It's going to affect our livelihoods. It's going to affect our natural environment, our ecosystem services. So many things are going to be impacted. But we also know that the impacts of climate change, you know, on different sectors of society, they are interrelated, right? And it's those impacts are really quite uneven across the country and the world, even within single communities. You know, the sorts of impacts can differ. Am I correct? Neighborhoods, individuals, it all, yeah, it's very, very different sort of impacts. How could you help explain how socioeconomic inequities sort of worsen the impacts on our more vulnerable members of society?
Yes, you're right. I think one of the striking features of climate change is inequalities. There are very much inequalities in how impacts affect different people in different communities. And we shouldn't forget as well, there are big inequalities in the activities that, that cause climate change. And often there's a kind of a big difference. One group largely responsible for the activities that cause climate change, and a different group largely feeling the impacts. And so, yeah, these inequalities are really a striking feature of climate change. If we think about those differing impacts of climate change, then one of the words you used, I think, was vulnerability or vulnerable. And that's a really important word. When scientists are trying to think about climate change in impacts, they're not only thinking about a climatic hazard like an extreme rainfall event or a heat wave. They're also thinking about the vulnerability of different populations. And that's just a phrase that is used in its usual sense, you know, the tendency to be affected by something. And they're also thinking about exposure. So you need to be in a particular place to be impacted by a climatic hazard. And like you said, you know, vulnerability to climate change is very much related to lots of other complex social and economic conditions. It's to do with poverty, it's to do with migration, it's to do with access to services, it's to do with education, it's to do with differing degrees of political influence. All of these things will feed into how vulnerable different individuals and communities are to climate change impacts. And often there are very kind of complex histories behind why different groups end up being vulnerable, could be related to things like colonialism as well. And you're right that it's those more vulnerable communities, often at the poorer end of the socioeconomic inequities, that end up being vulnerable. And they have fewer resources to cope at the time of a climatic event or climatic impact. If they want to recover after an event, it can also be harder in that perspective as well, again, with fewer resources to get ready for the next one. If they want to adapt, so this is an important word, adaptation to climate change, if they want to try and do something so that they're better prepared in future, again, having fewer resources makes that much harder. And so there are all these different ways that inequalities feed into being more vulnerable, and that can very much worsen the impacts from these climatic hazards. So again, I think it's something that is absolutely inescapable, these inequities. When we're talking about climate change, this should be very much one of the first things that we're thinking about.
Yeah, and we hear those arguments happening, isn't it, at things like the at the COP meetings and things like that. Those inequalities, these inequities, adaptation, financing, of course, you know, that's always a huge sticking point, isn't it, between the developing and the developed nations. And how much contribution, right? Who's contributed to the crisis? Who's contributing now? All of these things are always part of the discussion, isn't it?
It's highly contested. There's another phrase that is very much part of these international negotiations, loss and damage. And again, like you say, there is lots of ongoing debate about that. And it's very much related to financial needs and who should pay for what kind of action, what kind of adaptation. So that's a really important issue at the moment.
Okay. And I do know that last year, the 2021 IPCC report, so that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right? So when they released that report last year, they said that profound and long-term changes such as melting ice caps, rising temperatures and sea levels or ocean acidification, they've already been irreversibly set in motion. So some may say that, you know, everything is inevitable, right? And all these projections will come to pass. So really, there's nothing that we can do now. How would you respond to that?
Yes. So there are, as we've said, these changes that are already happening. We can see happening very quickly. And there is some inertia in the climate system. Once it started moving in a particular direction, that there are some parts of it that will t- tend to want to continue in that direction. But at the same time, there is some very important climate science to me. One of the very important findings in the last one or two decades of climate science that I think gives a more optimistic picture, a picture where we can do something and we can halt the dirt, or we can stop the changes. The finding that I'm thinking about is that the amount of warming we experience as a global average is very much related to the total amount of greenhouse gases we've emitted over time. And again, most of that is coming from burning fossil fuels. And so one of the big implications of that is if we could magically stop burning fossil fuels and putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere tomorrow, we'd pretty much stop warming where we are now, okay? And there's a concept that's also talked about some of the time. This is net zero. Mm-hmm. This phrase comes up. And that science I'm referring to is behind this idea of net zero. What we know that if we want to stop warming at a particular level, whether it's 1 degree or 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, at some point we need to get to zero emissions. The only way we can stop warming is to eventually get to zero emissions. Just the quicker we do it, the less warming hopefully we have, and the smaller the impacts associated with the overall global warming. So like I say, I think rather than nothing we can do, I think this is more something that gives us actually quite a lot of personal agency. It means that anything that we do to try and address the causes of climate change, these sources of greenhouse gases, if we can do something, then that would be our contribution to a global effort to try and slow down and then eventually stop the warming trend. But of course, it needs many, many people to be making those contributions for the difference to be noticeable on a global scale.
Mm-hmm. Rather than sort of taking this sort of fatalistic approach, isn't it, and not doing anything at all, there is science to prove that, you know, things can change, as you laid out. So
yeah,
we can't go the fatalistic route, basically, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. It's not kind of something that we couldn't stop. If this global scale action to very much slow down greenhouse gas emissions could happen, then the science is pretty clear that the warming would slow down a lot as well. Mm-hmm.
It's whether we do it now and whether, you know, the governments and the businesses actually, and people as well, you know, everybody sort of needs to work together. It's an all of society approach to take action and take action right now, right? It's not something that our children need to deal with. It's something that we need to deal with now.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, definitely. And I just wanted to bring up something, you know, on while we're speaking about IPCC. I think it was just yesterday, isn't it, that they released their latest report. And this one focused on climate solutions and regional and local adaptation. Would you have any sort of feedback from, you know, what was released? You know, any important takeaways from that report that were particularly important as far as you're concerned?
Yes. Maybe one of the first things I would say is that these reports that come from the IPCC, they might sound a bit kind of dry and technical, but to me, they're spectacular efforts, all right? They bring together so much technical information, try and analyze what it all means when brought together, and they end up with some very short, sharp, powerful messages, okay? The reports, you know, they do run into hundreds of pages, but if we look in particular in the right places, there are some extremely powerful messages. And they also, I think, come with a lot of credibility. So the reports are put together by big teams of scientists drawn from all across the world, and it's under the supervision of the United Nations. And at least the top-level summaries of these reports are effectively signed off by all the countries before they're published. Okay, so they do reflect a consensus of where we are at the moment, the current state of the climate change problem. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's great because it's very hard to argue against this as evidence that can inform decisions. Okay, it's really great to have this kind of unified presentation of all of this important information. There were one or two, you know, it was only published in the last day or so, but there are one or two, I think, interesting and important things that I would like to highlight if I can.
Sure.
So the main summary of the report, the final one or two sentences of that is a very powerful statement, and it follows, I think, from the comments you were just making. If I can, I'll just read it out. The cumulative scientific evidence is unequivocal. Climate change is a threat to human well-being and planetary health. Any further delay in action on adaptation and also mitigation will miss a brief and rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. So they do also emphasize the need to do things rather quickly. That's kind of an overall statement. There was also some interesting information about this issue of vulnerability that we talked about a few minutes ago. They have some numbers about how many, several billions of people living in contexts which are very vulnerable to climate change all around the world, especially in the kind of less developed parts of the world. They also have some statements about the differing impacts among people between differently vulnerable populations.
Okay.
So, for example, they talk about mortality from hazards like floods and droughts and storms being 15 times higher for very highly vulnerable regions and countries than it is in countries that are low on the vulnerability scale. So again, that is some very concrete information about stark differences in vulnerability. And one or two new things I think they're mentioning now, that there's good evidence about the effects of climate change on things like mental health. I'm not sure I've seen that in previous reports. And there are also, there's some information about which kind of assesses the action that is being taken to try and do adaptation. And not all of it is going well. They've pointed out that in some contexts, is that in some places they find what they're calling maladaption. So efforts to try and adapt to climate change that are actually not really helping. And so there are probably some very important lessons to be learned about trying to do those types of things more successfully.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So those were some of the things that I think are interesting. But again, I believe it. The existence of the report and these short summary statements that give a very powerful kind of consensus of where we are now, that's one of the main values, I think, in these reports.
Okay. All right. And we're definitely going to try and dissect that more, as people have time to digest it. I mean, I just got you on now, so not much time to go through that. It's a very robust report. From what I was reading, a lot of people said it's really stark, you know, some of the things that were mentioned. So that's something we definitely need to go through. But yeah, I guess, you know, the message also is that we need to do it now, right? It's not a future problem. It's a current problem. I don't know if you watched, and you were talking about anxiety. I don't know if you watched that show on Netflix, Don't Look Up. Did you catch it by any chance?
I've heard about it. I haven't seen it. No.
Okay. It's basically like there's something coming to destroy Earth and everybody's like, oh, really? And not doing anything to sort of, you know, mitigate or do anything about it. So here we are. It sounds quite familiar. But let's just go for one more quick break, Matt. And when we come back, I'm going to get you to sort of bust some myths, some climate crisis myths. I'm speaking today to Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist. He's also an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He is also part of the team behind the Bite-Sized Climate Action, which is a series of very fun, flexible, immersive modules designed by experts in the conservation field to inspire Malaysian youth to act for the climate. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to There's No Planet B on Earth Matters, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's another episode of There's No Planet B, our series where we want to share everything you need to know about the climate crisis. So in our first episode, we spoke about why we're in a climate crisis. Today, we're speaking about the effects of the climate crisis. And joining me to do that is Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist. He's an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He's also part of the team behind Bite-Sized Climate Action. And we'll talk a little bit more about that after this. this. But Matt, if you can help me do some myth busting, okay? So these are some of these. I've crowdsourced some of these from the internet. Some of these I've heard myself, you know, even from professors, even from university professors. Can you help me bust these? Okay, so the first myth is climate change is natural and normal. It happened at other points in history. How would you respond to that?
Okay, yeah, very happy to think about these myths. Climate change is natural and normal. In the past, yes, and scientists have studied many of these past changes which we know were to do with natural causes. And I think I would argue that the understanding of those past events gives us more confidence about what we're seeing now, because we realize that there are all these natural ways that climate can change. For example, the ice ages over the past hundreds of thousands of years, scientists have linked those to quite small changes in how Earth orbits the sun and how energy is distributed across Earth's surface in different seasons. And because we have understanding of these past changes, scientists are confident in saying, well, none of these things are happening now. The changes we're seeing now, we can only explain when we account for the very quick increases in greenhouse gases and the extra heating they cause in the atmosphere. And there are also, I think, some important signatures or fingerprints of warming that is related to increases in greenhouse gases. And these things were predicted by the very earliest climate models 50, 60 years ago. There was a recent Nobel Prize for Physics awarded to one of those early climate modelers. Things like the amount of warming in the polar regions being a bit more than in other parts of the world. Other things like actually higher up in the atmosphere, maybe 15 or 20 kilometers above the surface, we find cooling. And that's what we expect if greenhouse gases are warming the lower atmosphere. So all of these things are signatures of a warming that's caused by increases in greenhouse gases. And we know those greenhouse gases are coming from burning fossil fuels. So yes, in the past, climate changed a lot for natural reasons. None of those things are causing it now. It's very clearly to do with these increases in greenhouse gases, mostly coming from fossil fuels being burned.
Mm-hmm. So human activities as well, pretty much, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the other myth I'm hoping for you to bust, this one. There's no consensus among scientists that climate change is real. Your response?
Well, I think there is a consensus.
IPCC.
I mean, the IPCC we've just talked about, that's one very good example. And again, the scientists are drawn from all over the world. And it's all kind of convened by the United Nations. I don't think too many people are now arguing that climate change is not real. I think a lot of some of the deniers that are out there who previously were arguing that climate change is not happening are now realizing that because of the size of the changes that are being observed, that's not tenable anymore. And so some of those smaller number of deniers are maybe more focusing on advocating against particular solutions to climate change or particular societal changes that might be proposed to address climate change, rather than disputing whether climate change is happening at all.
Okay. All right. The other one would be plants and animals can adapt.
So certainly plants and animals do and have in the past adapted to changes in their environment. We know over quite long periods of time that ecosystems respond in different ways to quite gradual changes in climatic conditions. But the changes that have happened within the last 100 years and that have been accelerating in recent decades are extremely rapid indeed, relative to those past natural changes. And I think a lot of the time it's the speed of the change that plants and animals find it very difficult to adjust to. So that we mentioned this recent IPCC report, the one published just in the last day or two. So they do mention something about this. They're saying that changes in climate are already exceeding plants and animals' tolerance thresholds, driving mass mortalities in species such as trees and also corals, which we mentioned before.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's not an argument there then. And I think the final one that I was hoping you could address was, and this was strange to me, climate change is good for us.
Okay. Yeah, that is an interesting one. I think certainly some people would say that climate change is not necessarily always bad, but you might make a statement like that if you only have quite a narrow focus. So there are probably some parts of the world, and I think particularly away from the equator towards regions that are sometimes quite cold, in those parts of the world, some of the maybe increases in temperature or changes in rainfall, it could do things like slightly enhance agricultural productivity. If those places were usually pretty cold, it might, for example, lengthen growing seasons. Right. And so you might hear some arguments, but again, they'd be from quite a narrow perspective. I think if you take a more, I think, appropriate global type of perspective, look across the world, think about all the vulnerable groups that are out there, then I don't think this kind of statement really holds up. And again, if I think to just in the last day or so, associated with this recent IPCC report, there was a statement from the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, and he described the report as an atlas of human suffering. Okay, so it's it's short words, but it's not consistent with this idea that climate change might be good with us.
Okay. I'm going to use that, an atlas of human suffering.
Yes, that's what he said.
That's something I'm going to steal and use as well with these. It tends to be, I don't know. It happens, you know, especially since I've been doing this show for 10 years. They're like, what are you on about? You know, seriously, it's nothing. You're just, you know, you're just hyping up all these scientists who are, you know, on somebody's payroll. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. It's happening and it's important. And, you know, before I let you go again, would you have a final message to our listeners, you know, on why we should care about the climate change? And let's not forget, you also have a bite-sized climate action going. Yeah, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what's happening there as well.
Yes, of course. So why should we care about climate change? And maybe thinking about the examples of people you just mentioned, I think to me the most obvious answer is that climate change will definitely affect things that we care about. That's why we should care about climate change. And I think many of us, it's possible we haven't noticed yet. And it's possible we could be fortunate and not suffer from a climatic disaster directly, like a flood, anytime soon. I think that's not something that necessarily everyone will experience soon. But climate change and the way that society is going to respond to it, I think is more and more going to impact almost everything, the places we live, how our businesses operate, the people around us, and especially young people and vulnerable people in our communities. It's going to affect our environmental quality. And I think more and more how we feel about the world, our sense of happiness, our sense of well-being. And as soon as we start to think about climate change and the causes behind it and the impacts that we expect to continue, if we think about it more carefully, then I think it can offend the values that a lot of us will hold dearly, things to do with justice and fairness and helping people in our community. All of these things are going to increasingly come up within the context of climate change. To me, I think it's really great if we don't wait until we feel like we've personally been dealt a very obvious impact. There are people already being impacted in very obvious direct ways. We might be lucky not to be among them, but I think more and more this issue is going to creep into our lives in lots of different ways. And so I think it's great if we can do something very urgently to try and address climate change and try to avoid even worse impacts. And so you mentioned bite-sized climate action. Maybe I'll just say something about that in finishing. This is a website that I was involved in developing along with colleagues at University of Malaya. And it contains content that we hope is interesting and accessible and relevant to younger people in Malaysia. And it gives, I think, some good ideas about different things that we can do in many different areas of our lives to try and contribute to climate action, and also to engage with other people effectively to help them to do things that will kind of be more climate friendly.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and for you know, all that wonderful explanation that you gave. Really, really clear and very concise. And again, I guess, you know, if anybody's interested to find out more about Bite Size Climate Action, they just need to go to, you have a Wix site, you've got social media channels as well. Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. So just search for Bite Size Climate Action and you can find all of it there. There's modules, there's ways you can get involved, you know, ways to educate yourself and learn more about the climate crisis as well. It's really, everything is there. So do go and search for that. My thanks again to my guest today, Dr. Matthew Ashfold. He's an atmospheric scientist and an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He is also part of the team behind Bite Size Climate Action. And if you miss any part of our conversation or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can always search for the podcasts at bfm.my/earth, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.